Well, welcome to the Danny Meyer Teleseminar, sponsored by Restaurant Bootcamp. My name is Susie Beeler. I am with Susie Beeler & Company, a San Francisco restaurant PR and marketing firm. I am so pleased to welcome famed New York restaurateur and author Danny Meyer. Welcome, Danny.
Thank you, Susie, and welcome to everybody on the line.
Thank you. Well, you've been a longtime mentor of mine. I can remember going into Union Square Cafe about 20 years ago, having a wonderful meal, and leaving you a handwritten note. When I got back to San Francisco, I had a personalized card from you. And I have just treasured that card, and I can certainly understand how you embody hospitality. So we are just delighted to have you today. Just to give everybody a little bit of background on yourself, CEO of Union Square Hospitality Group in New York City. Danny's company owns 11 businesses. The majority of them are fine dining restaurants. His restaurants and chefs have earned an unprecedented 17 James Beard Awards, and all of his restaurants have earned 3 stars from the New York Times, and we know what a tremendous accomplishment that is. Danny's latest book, Setting the Table, examines the power of hospitality in restaurants, business, and life. So, Danny, why don't we just jump right in, and we do acknowledge you for giving us this hour. Tell us, how did you begin in the restaurant business?
I began in the restaurant business a little bit differently than people do today. I'm going to go backwards, but one of the things I'm proudest about our industry today is that, you know, a young person doesn't have to apologize quite to the same degree as some of us other older people did when they tell their parents that they want to be in the restaurant business. It used to be something that was not considered an especially valid career choice, especially if you were had been sent away to a liberal arts college or something.
Sure.
In my case, what had already begun to happen a little bit back in the 1980s, the mid-1980s, is that a handful of folks had entered the, with some advanced degrees in college, had entered the restaurant business through the kitchen door. And, you know, we are starting to see the very, very beginnings of the celebrity chef in this country.
Mm-hmm.
People like Wolfgang Puck and Alice Waters and Jeremiah Tower and, you know, all kinds of folks like that. And so I thought that the way that I could most convince my parents that the best thing to do with my political science degree was to go into the restaurant business was to tell them I was going to be a chef. And my dad had been in the travel business, working with Relais & Chateau for many, many years, and then he had a tour company. And he hooked me up with a couple of his friends, one in Italy and one in Bordeaux, two in Bordeaux, actually. And I got myself trained for a very, very short while as a stagiaire. And during the time that I was abroad cooking, it really dawned on me that as much as I had always loved cooking my whole life and always basically remembered every meal I had ever had, that it would probably not ultimately be the best way for me to get in the restaurant business because my interests are far broader and I didn't necessarily have the patience to dedicate 10 years to learning how to be a great chef. So that's a very long story made very short, but I think you told me, Susie, that a couple of the folks on the line had read Setting the Table. It took me almost 2 chapters to answer that question, so I did the best I could in a short moment there.
Well, it's good to know, and I think it's great that just to acknowledge what a valued career choice being in the restaurant business is today, because we've certainly seen it evolve.
It's absolutely a valid career choice. I think the bigger story for me, which has almost nothing to do with the restaurant business, is just what a privilege it is when any human being can follow their passion. And it's, you know, I likened it to a friend recently by saying it's almost if you have a life passion to do something, you don't always know what it is, but it's like a mosquito bite, and until you scratch it, it's going to drive you absolutely crazy. And for me, nobody my age, who had been studying political science or English literature or anything was going into the restaurant business. So it was a bizarre thing,
sure.
which happily it's not today.
Right.
But I had to get it out of my system, and I'm just so glad I did.
Well, and lucky for you, 27 is still fairly young to dive into the restaurant
yeah.
business. So I believe that was when you opened Union Square Cafe? You were 27?
I was 27 when I opened Union Square Cafe. I was 25 and 26 when I had my first restaurant job in a seafood restaurant here in New York. And then I just went for it. I was totally not expert. I was completely intuitive about trying to treat people the way I wanted to be treated. Not a very new idea, by the way.
Well, let me ask you this with regard to Union Square Cafe. I read something that, I don't know if it was a reviewer or you that said that Union Square Cafe in its 23 years became a wonderful restaurant because of its imperfections. What imperfections can be an asset and which are a liability? And how do you tell them apart?
Well, hopefully all imperfections become an asset because that's our job security as human beings. But in the case of Union Square Cafe specifically, it is a very, very odd space. It was a 50-year-old vegetarian restaurant whose lease I purchased. I purchased the last 14 years of the lease, and it was a hodgepodge of a long lunch counter with a very low ceiling in the back, above which was the owner's office, toilet, and 49 years of stored records. This is before we had computers.
Sure.
And then next door, through a brick wall, was his vitamin store. And I had the fortune one night of traipsing all over Manhattan, well before opening Union Square Cafe, trying to figure out which restaurant space I was going to pick for this dream of mine. And I did my own personal tour through all of downtown New York on a very cold winter night back in the winter of 1984, early 1985 maybe. Having a different glass of wine or cocktail at about 15 places, I have no idea how I even managed to make it all the way to the bottom of Manhattan, but I found myself at an old tapas bar called El Teddy's. And as I was sitting at the tapas bar, about 8 drinks into my night, it dawned on me that this tapas bar was the exact mirror image of what Brownie's Vegetarian Restaurant could be if only I were to knock through this wall to his vitamin store. And I feverishly started scribbling on, the little thin napkins they give you at a tapas bar.
Sure.
And I took the idea to a friend in the restaurant business the very next Monday, so, a couple days after that. And I just got to work on it. And what made it imperfect, there are actually, there are 6 levels, 6 different levels in this restaurant. So it's almost impossible to go more than 1,000 square feet without having to walk up or down stairs. There are many, many different areas that are too narrow.
Mm-hmm.
The ceilings are too high, too low, too crowded. And it just doesn't make sense in terms of anything you would ever design as a restaurant. The women's bathroom can barely fit any women,
Yeah, it sounds like you got all of your major challenges in that first site.
I think so, but I also think that adversity, overcoming adversity, can
sure.
become a great strength. It can build the character of a team, and I'm
Absolutely.
Almost positive that it makes for a more interesting dining experience over time because it's just when you see a group of people serving you who are overcoming all these different challenges, and yet in the face of this amazing bonhomie and people are having a good time, it almost makes it feel all the better.
That must be a good feeling. Well, let me ask another question. It seems that the dining public is obsessed with what's new and what's hot. Despite that, your concepts have endured the test of time. What do you do in your restaurants to ensure lasting popularity?
That's a great question. You get basically one chance to be new, and after that you're old. And I think the bloom on the word new is probably shorter than ever. I think the shelf life of innovation thanks to the internet, with instant information and instant communication, is about as short as it's ever been in the history of the world. So I think it is important to launch a restaurant with a fresh idea that addresses something that people have experienced before, perhaps in a fresh way, a slightly different perspective than they've ever seen it. You know, I've had people say that, oh my God, I can't believe what a, you know, great invention Shake Shack is, or, you know, when we open Tabla, our Indian restaurant. The fact is, we have never invented anything, and I don't know of any of us who have ever invented anything. There's 8 notes in the octave, and the reason that you can write a fresh song is you just rearrange the notes a little differently than the next guy did. So the way we've been able to endure is to first start with something that rearranges the notes a little differently. We are not ever interested in following what has already been looked at in the exact same way. But then I would say a good year into it, when it's no longer exciting just because it's new, then you got to get good, and you have to have been engaged since day one in an ongoing dialogue with your guests and with your staff, where, yes, it's your point of view, however you opened your restaurant, but it's their choice whether they're ever going to come back. And so I think the key thing is to constantly be listening and responding and measuring your responses against your own gut instincts, but also listening very, very carefully to what your guests want. And what's exciting about that is that over time, as the restaurant breaks in, it really becomes something that you never could have made on your own. It's kind of like a baseball glove. If you buy it in a store, it's stiff and it looks a certain way, and it really only breaks in response to the catch that you're playing with a whole lot of different people. And you never can be sure what your baseball glove is going to look like after 5 or 6 or 7 years. It's the same thing with a restaurant. And if you stay on top of things, stay on top of you know, the relationships with your guests and with your staff, it's worked for us. We've never put a place out of business yet in 22 years.
And that is pretty amazing. I mean, we know the failure rate of restaurants is, what, 60%? I mean, come on, tell us the truth, Danny. Have you ever come close to one of your restaurants closing?
No, we never have. And I think that part of the reason is that we're just always making adjustments. And we really try to listen. I feel like this is the third time I've said it, but by listening carefully to our staff and to our guests, we pretty much stay ahead of what we need to do to make the place better. Now, one thing that's worked incredibly well for us, every now and then we get a call from some professional company that wants to sell their services as, I think they call themselves spotters, where you pay them.
Mystery diners or something, yeah.
Mystery shoppers.
Mm-hmm.
And we've never been interested in that. What we do instead is that when someone has worked for us for a period of at least 90 days, they qualify for our dining program. And they are, so all of our employees who have been with us for at least 90 days are entitled to dine in either the restaurant they work in, or they can rotate through our other restaurants in exchange for filing a critique of the experience. And what we've learned from that is whatever amount of money that program costs us pays for itself many, many fold, because all at once the staff members get a sense of pride. It reaffirms why they work in the restaurant they work in or the company they work in. If it's a waiter, they take extra pride, I think, in the work of their not only their waiter colleagues but also of the cooks. If it's a cook, they get a chance to see how hard the waiters work. If they're eating in one of our other restaurants, they get a chance to see what we have in common and what's different. And most importantly, what an amazing dynamic to have my staff members telling me what I need to do to improve our places.
It's absolutely. They
so much better than me, than reversing those roles.
Right. They feel a sense of ownership, too, because they can, they're going to be listened to. And do most of them participate? You must have employees dining in your restaurants almost every night.
All the time.
That's
and as, you know, here we are on at the end of the month here, they've got to use their credit before the end of each month. And
I
so
see.
I would say on a night like tonight, we'll probably have a ton of our own staff members dining in our restaurants.
Well, I know the philosophy in your book rates your employees as the first stakeholders in your company. What exactly does that mean, and how do you implement that philosophy? And at the same, you know, the second part is, what are the five emotional skills you require of every employee you hire? Because I know you go into that in pretty detail in your book.
Well, it dawned on me a long time ago that you were nice enough to talk about the success our restaurants have had. One of the main reasons I wrote Setting the Table was to try to figure out what we were doing that was working so well. I come into work every day like most of us probably and try to look at our mistakes from yesterday, but something was really working. I mean, the Zagat survey lists something. I don't know how many restaurants are in it. There's about 22,000 restaurants in the city, huge mortality rate, as you said. And if you look at the category, which is New Yorkers' favorite restaurants, five of the top 40 restaurants, I think, excuse me, five of the top 30 restaurants are ours.
That's impressive.
Including the top two have been ours for the last decade or so. And so I decided I should try to find out what that means, because we've never had five of the top 30 food scores or five of the top 30 decor or service scores, the three things that got asked about. And what hit me like a lightning rod is that if we were doing that much better when the category was now name your favorite restaurant, which, by the way, I think is anytime someone says my favorite anything, I think it's about the ultimate compliment they can pay, you know, whatever the subject is, whether it's a restaurant or a professor or an aunt, whatever.
Right, sure.
And it dawned on me that Zagat was not asking a question that we were probably thriving at more than anything, and that was hospitality. And that's what I really wanted to focus on in writing the book, because I'm an incredibly intuitive and not an incredibly analytical person. And I forced myself to really articulate for myself and then for my staff members what I meant when I used the word hospitality, and how did the word hospitality differ from the word service, because it was certainly not a distinction anyone had ever drawn for me in the past. And I went into that very, very deeply in my own mind, and I found that I spent many, many chapters in a book, which I'm not going to do right now, but in a nutshell, service is a great way to measure the degree to which an organization technically delivers the goods. Did you do what you said you were going to do? And if you don't have great service, you're out of business today. In the old days, I think having great service would maybe help distinguish you as a great enterprise, but today it's gotten to the point that if you don't do it, you lose. If you do it, you're only in the game. Hospitality, on the other hand, is a great way to measure the degree to which you made the recipient of the service feel good. So, I'll take a dry cleaner as an example. If I ask for my suit to be back on Thursday, and it's delivered on Thursday, that's good service. If it's delivered on Friday, that's bad service.
Mm-hmm.
If when they deliver it, they say, by the way, how was your son's softball game? Because they remember that when I took in my dirty laundry, I was with my son wearing his softball uniform, that's hospitality. That has a lot to do with how they make me feel. And by going very, very deeply into those two subjects, you really see that the defining factor in what can make any business somebody else's favorite has everything to do with how you made them feel. It has a small amount to do with how excellent the product is. And I say small, it's all relative. In the book, measure the performance at about 40% of the reason someone would 49% of the reason someone would return, and the hospitality at about 51% of the reason somebody would return. Now, as far as our stakeholders are concerned, you got to determine, if you're the boss, you get to decide how you're going to prioritize your stakeholders. There's no business in the world that does not have the same five stakeholders. We all have customers, suppliers, investors, community in which we do business, and employees. We have those five stakeholders. And if you're the business owner, you get to determine who comes first. And I didn't sit in a room and decide what to do. I sat in a room and tried to analyze what we had been doing that had been working so well, that was making these restaurants the kind that people would just return to and return to. And I realized that we had created what I call a virtuous cycle of enlightened hospitality, where it's not a linear list, you know, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, but it's a cycle. And in the cycle, we found that we were first requiring that our staff offer hospitality to one another. Secondly, to our customers. So we were putting our customers second, which I found very odd. We were putting our community third, our suppliers fourth, and our investors fifth. And the two big surprises for me were that by putting our customers second, we were actually creating more customer satisfaction. And by putting our investors fifth, we were creating more sustained profitability cycle. And the reason is that much like a vicious cycle where one bad thing keeps leading to something even worse, in a virtuous cycle, one good thing keeps leading to something better. So, in fact, if you want to be more profitable, you would never put your investors first because they wouldn't benefit from the virtuous cycle.
Well, it's like a ripple effect, it sounds like it.
Absolutely. Mm-hmm. And, you know, chefs have known this forever, that If the key ingredients for hospitality are your people, and
absolutely,
you know, a chef knows that you can have the best recipe in the world, it's never going to taste any better than the quality of the worst ingredient you put into it, but also the quality of the respect and care that you accorded that ingredient. I can go
right
take my grandmother's tomato sauce recipe. If I don't start with good tomatoes, it's not going to be very good. And if I bruise the tomatoes and throw them in the refrigerator, it's also not going to be good. So the same thing holds true of the people on your team. You've got to pick them better than anybody else, and you got to make sure that they treat one another and that they feel treated with a huge degree of care and respect. And, you know, I didn't invent that either. That's mm-hmm. well written in a terrific book called Servant Leadership, which is basically that you just take the hierarchical structure of your business and flip it upside down. You're still the boss, but your primary job is to serve the people who you are asking to serve your customers, as opposed to commanding the people who you want to serve your customers.
So we have a caller, John, that wants to know, how do you find people that sparkle, passionate people?
It's a hard time in the history of our country to be hiring anybody, just because there are fewer human beings in the labor pool of, now that a huge number of baby boomers have retired. We're in a good, one of the silver linings in any recession, however, is that it's a great time to hire. And so these people are out there. And it starts by naming, once again, the two very different skill sets. And 49% of what we look for are somebody's technical skills, how good of a cook they are, how good of a waiter they are, how much they already know about wine. Those are all skills that can be taught, but the 51% of the skills we look for are what I call the HQ skills, the hospitality quotient skills. And just like it's impossible to teach anybody to have a different IQ than they already have, you can't teach someone to have a different HQ. I would define HQ as a way to measure the degree to which somebody actually derives pleasure from the act of providing someone else with pleasure. So when you talk about the word sparkling, I'm thinking about the word HQ, and I'm thinking about the kind of emotional skills, and again, I spent a lot of time writing about this and setting the table, but the basic things that we look for are kindness, curiosity, work ethic, empathy, self-awareness, and integrity. And those are all things we don't know how to teach, but we do know how to spot, and we know how to teach people how to spot them as well. And if you've got someone who have who come with those HQ skills, trust me, they are going to do a whole lot more with, the definition of Sancerre than someone who doesn't have those skills. So that the technical skills really do become sparkling in the hands of someone with a high HQ.
So it's really your ability to train managers to spot those HQ skills as they hire them.
I'm afraid I didn't hear you, Susie.
It's really your ability, it's your manager's ability to spot those skills, so you train them on spotting them.
We do, and we have some serious training for that very, very topic, which is how to hire for a high HQ. And believe me, it really, you're not going to do any better than the degree to which your manager is doing the hiring understand this. By the way, one blind spot that many of us have who do the hiring, a lot of times companies take people who have a high HQ and make them responsible for doing the hiring, and that's a good thing, I think. But there is a blind spot that's important to recognize, and that's that people with a high HQ in an interview situation are inadvertently often trying to make the interviewee feel comfortable. And that's sometimes something that can get in the way of your ability to assess
right.
whether the person you're interviewing is going to make your own customers feel comfortable.
Sure.
So we've got some techniques to get around that as well.
Yeah, well, I can see how important that would be. So when you open a restaurant, how much time before you open it do you allot for actual training in the restaurant?
Never enough. Every time we've opened something, we've promised that we would do a little bit better than we did the last time. And the problem really is this, and I'm not saying that we won't keep always doing better and saying we're going to do better, but I'll be darned if the real estate prices in Manhattan, which is where so far we've opened our restaurants, are so high that you just cannot afford to be paying rent for too long without having some income. And then secondly,
that first dollar, yeah.
Secondly, the same thing holds true of construction, not just in terms of cost, but in terms of how long it takes to get it done. And it's amazing how your best laid plans can fall apart quickly in terms of all that extra training. However, I don't want to diminish the work that our team does, because we have a really strong process, just like I'm sure many, many restaurants do, in terms of orientation, cultural training, as well as technical training, and then all the typical kind of run-throughs. But I've never opened a restaurant where I didn't say, gosh, we could have done so much more if we just had two more weeks or three more weeks or whatever.
And is it generally usually about a couple weeks?
I don't think we've ever found more than 2 weeks. I think we've always wished we could have at least 1 month.
Sure.
And, you know, a lot of times, one of the things that can hold you up is the kitchen equipment and the kitchen hookups and the gas hookups. And
the chairs didn't show up, et cetera.
Yeah, so one of the benefits to having a handful of restaurants is that we can get cooks cooking. And we've got private dining rooms, and we've got a catering company now, so that we can get cooks cooking even if it's not their own kitchen. But it's never the same thing as playing on your own home field. And, by the way, no matter how much practice you do, at a certain point you just got to get out there and play some games. And then the tough thing is that the minute you open your doors, there's a huge population. This is a double-edged sword, a huge population who just has to be first at trying out the new place. And unfortunately, you get a huge number of influential first opinions when you're at your absolute busiest and worst.
Well, how
but
do you...
it's all good.
All good. Well, Danny, how do you work with the stress of being in the restaurant business? Because obviously it's a high stress. You have to listen to everyone. And how do you manage your managers on dealing with that daily stress?
You know, I think the restaurant business is a little bit of a zen game. You do have to kind of master your own energy and your own emotions. One of the stories that I tell our managers all the time is to imagine that we are surfers. And there are probably some surfers in the world who spend a fair amount of their energy cursing the waves. But I would say that the champion surfers, number one, acknowledge that without the waves, they don't get to be surfers. They can just be in a bathtub at that point. And furthermore, I would say the most champion surfers actually relish an occasional really, really, really big wave, because while everybody else is falling off their surfboard, those are the guys that either distinguish themselves by staying on their surfboard because they're using all their energy for style, or they're just showing the best form, etc. And our business, I would say probably all business, but certainly the restaurant business, is truly one wave after another. And if you don't like that, you just shouldn't be a surfer. There's always something that's going to go wrong and not go according to plan. And I think there are people who love it and who relish that and who love to use their calm to become champions. And that's the kind of people I really look for on our team.
That's great. Well, I especially like your salt story in the book about always coming back to your center. And that was that one of your good, was it a mentor that shared that with you?
It was. Early in my career, I'll go way back. Remember I told you that I had bought the last 14 years of a lease from a 49-year-old vegetarian restaurant called Brownies. And old man Brown, Sam Brown, was retiring. He was probably close to 80 years old. He was asthmatic. And so to celebrate the deal that we had made, I was very surprised that he chose to take me to his favorite restaurant, a steakhouse called Sparks. And it turned out that he had been sneaking out of his vegetarian restaurant for years to go eat meat. And he wanted to take me to this place, Sparks. And literally from the moment we got to Sparks, the owner of the restaurant, Pat Setta, who has since passed away, sat down with us and basically interviewed me for 2 or 3 hours and couple bottles of wine, and he turned out to be a mentor of mine. He was, a very, very sort of idiosyncratic Brooklyn Italian guy. Someone from the mob had been murdered outside of his restaurant.
Oh, my goodness.
I never saw him without a big stain on his tie, and we couldn't have been more different than night and day. But he picked me as a mentee, and he would just show up at Union Square Cafe once every 6 or 7 weeks, and it was always perfect timing when I was having some problem that I needed to learn about. And one day I was sitting down with him at a table. It was between lunch and dinner service, and I was complaining about how I was having a really tough time getting some of the waiters who were actually older than I was to follow my lead. I was 27. I hired some people my age. I hired a lot of people older than me. And I said, I can't get these guys to listen to me, and they keep doing it their own way. And he sat me down. He said, listen, Lova, I'm going to give you a lesson. I want you to clear everything off this table. So I cleared everything off. And he said, all right, now go grab that salt shaker. So I grab the salt shaker, and he says, now put the salt shaker in, right on the center of the table. And I put it down, and he goes, no, I said on the center of the table. And I said, it is. And he said, no, it's not. Look closely. So I moved it, like a half an inch, so it was as square in the center as I could see it. And he said, is that good? And I go, yep. And then he moves it off center. And he said, now put it back. So I put it back. And he moves it off again. And he does this about 2 or 3 times. And he said, if you can just understand this, your center is where you want that salt shaker. And that's your job. Your job is to figure out where you want the salt shaker. And he said, their job, meaning the staff, the guests, everybody, is to move the salt shaker off the center. He said, that's what they do. And it's totally not worth your while to use any of your energy getting upset about it. It is totally worth your job and critical to your job that you move it back every time. And he said if you move it back every single time, calmly, what happens is that it gets moved off center less frequently and less far each time. If you stop moving it back to your center, you're going to end up having a situation where you'll be spending all of your time incredibly frustrated. Your standards will drop. And he said at that point, you may as well just give the keys away to the staff because it'll be their restaurant and not yours. So that was a great story for me. It's something that I apply to my life. Also, as a father of four kids,
sure.
that's what their job is. And it just helps me not get so upset about it. And I know what my job is as well.
Well, and how important to know your center. So, Danny, you know, you mentioned a mentor and him. How important is it that restaurant owners, especially all the many restaurant owners that are independents, that are, you know, are the sole owner, how important is it to them to have mentors or coaches that can guide them along?
Well, for me, it's been critical, Susie. And it's not, I would say that even though I just gave you an example of a mentor who had been in the restaurant business, for whatever reason, most of my mentors are not actually in the restaurant business. And it's an interesting thing. Sometime I'd like to read a book, it probably exists, about why mentors pick mentees and why mentees pick mentors. It's a fascinating relationship. And I've been very, very fortunate to, I've got three or four right now that are mentors as friends. And it's clear that there's something that I bring to the party by allowing them to mentor me. I'm never quite clear what it is I'm giving them, but each one of them has different gifts that help keep me centered. And then additionally, it's been important for me and for my company to have a professional coach. And we work together with her in a very, very intensive way, probably once every 2 years, and then in a brush-up way, probably once a quarter.
What's some advice on locating a coach? How would somebody go about that?
Well, I don't really know because I'm not expert at how you go about finding a coach. I know that we found ours through happenstance because I was greeting a couple in our dining room and many, many years ago talking about how challenging it was to grow from my first to my second restaurant, Union Square Cafe, to Gramercy Tavern. And I said I've hit a roadblock in terms of figuring out how to split my time, and I don't know, I probably unleashed about six or seven things that were challenging. I knew this couple, by the way. And what I didn't know was that the wife says, well, I've got someone you should absolutely talk to who is the greatest organizational development consultant I've ever met in my life. And the woman was an executive at Nickelodeon at the time. Mm-hmm. And she said, and this woman happens to be the sister of my husband here. So they both certainly recommended her, the brother and the sister-in-law.
So it sounds like you don't have to look far. It's probably within your own circle.
It's there somewhere. And we just lucked into someone who's been amazing for us, whose company is called Proteus.
Great. Well, Sam, one of our callers, is asking, what suggestions for aspiring new restaurateurs do you have?
Oh, wow, that's a big one. Know why you're in the business. I think that an aspiring young restaurateur should really be able to check off these three boxes, in my opinion. The first one is that when you go to work each day, you know that it's going to fill your gas tank every single time you are able to deliver joy to somebody else, whether it's someone who works for you or one of your guests. That is a huge, huge thing to be focused on. Number two, I would say that it fills your gas tank whenever you go more deeply into the actual product you're serving, the food, the wine, the beverage, that you really, really take your own joy in the product, and you take joy in sharing that joy with others. And then thirdly, that it fills your gas tank to compete and to be incredibly athletic about how you train yourself for stamina, et cetera. The reason that I would pick those three things is that those three things are, they're just completely critical to a successful restaurant. It's got to be a place that provides people with joy. It's got to be a place where the guests can tell that the people serving the food and wine and beverage really love that product and understand that product and are constantly trying to improve the product. And let's face it, I would say relative to many, many, many other businesses, it's about as competitive as it gets.
Mm-hmm.
And as soon as you think you're sitting in Schaefer City, there's somebody breathing down your neck. So you better be competitive as well. And I would say, and the reason that I started each one of those saying it fills your gas tank is that not only do you have to do those three things, but it's actually got to feed you to do those three things. And if doing those three things makes you happy, it's truly a self-perpetuating success model. And I feel incredibly privileged that that I can check all three of those boxes to this day.
That's great. You certainly got to nourish your spirits on all different levels, don't you?
Yep.
So Tim is asking, why have you never rolled out one of your concepts more broadly?
Well, Tim, I asked myself the exact same question. We're actually about to change that because it's a whole new skill set for me to try to replicate something. We have 12 different businesses. The reason I say businesses is that I'd call 7 of them restaurants. I wouldn't call the catering company a restaurant or the jazz club a restaurant, etc. But it's a fact. Up until now, I've never done the same one twice. And for the first time this year, we are going to open another Shake Shack, another anything.
Oh, okay.
And we're very, very excited about it, and we're structuring ourselves so that we can learn that new skill. I think someone who has 11 or 12 of the same thing knows how to do something I don't know how to do. I may know how to do something they don't know. I have an endless endless supply of ideas to come up with new ways of doing a restaurant, and I'd like to try to learn the discipline of doing one of them more than once.
It looks like you're about to find out.
Yep.
Tom is asking, how important is espresso in a restaurant's portfolio?
Very important if you like caffeine. I think the cliche answer would be that it's the last impression you're going to be making at the restaurant. But I think that any detail in the restaurant has to be something you care about. I think that if any restaurant is to succeed, it only succeeds because you earn the regular patronage of your clientele, or at least a huge percentage of your clientele chooses to come back. The worst kiss of death is if I could have a secret microphone outside of the door of our restaurant and I could hear the first comment people made when they left, I think we could learn a lot. The worst comment would be, you know, that was my first and last visit. I get it. I don't need to go back.
Right.
The only way you get people to become regulars is to keep surprising them with your attention to every detail. There's no question that coffee is a hugely important detail for a very good reason. Not just because it's the last impression, but it's one of those things that people can compare apples to apples. Every restaurant serves coffee, and not every restaurant has photographs on the wall. So let's say I have photographs on the wall. I may think they're beautiful. The fact is, it's art, and you know, you're not going to get everybody saying, I am going to come back or not going to come back because of that photograph on the wall. But when every restaurant has coffee, every time they taste your coffee, they are now comparing your entire quality and everything you've done to every other restaurant they've been to. So you better get it right. And if you do get it right, it's a great opportunity to distinguish yourself. Same thing holds true for things like bread. Same thing holds true for things like how you price your beer. Everybody's probably got the same beer you have. So really, what value are you adding to the beer? There's really only three things you can add to the value of beer: how cold you got it, how you price it, and what kind of glassware you used. So it's that level of detail that if you really want to distinguish yourself, you've got to do, and especially in the areas that everybody's already familiar with.
Sure. Well, and, you know, you talk a lot about listening, you know, listening to employees, listening to your customers. With the role technology is playing with all the online communities, how do you monitor your customer feedback? Because I'm sure that you're Yelped a lot with all of your restaurants. Do you have certain programs set up to work with those to monitor the results and respond?
Well, I think there's probably no substitute at the end of the day than watching your cover counts. I think that is for us the same thing as the heart monitor to a doctor in the hospital. Secondly, we have always given out comment cards at our restaurants to give people an opportunity who didn't already express themselves to one of our managers or to one of our waiters, an opportunity to write stuff down, and we get lots and lots and lots of those. We also use newsletters as a way to encourage dialogue. I think the key thing for people is to let them know that you want to hear from them. And the more you do that at the restaurant and through your own PR materials, could be your marketing materials, it could be your website, the more you get to deal with problems where the problem is occurring.
Right there.
Unless you have to deal with the terrorist attack of a blog that, you know, gets you from the rear and you didn't even know who wrote it. That said, we also, I would say that, and I don't require this, but most of our general managers and even some of our chefs do a Google alert on their restaurant name. Mm-hmm. And that lets them stay up to date on what is being said on the web. And, we don't tend to miss too many broad items because, remember what I said, we have 1,500 staff members between all of our restaurants. And so that's an army of people eating in our places all the time, giving us critiques. I ate in one of our restaurants last night with the chef and general manager, and we were critiquing ourselves. So we just really try to stay ahead of it, and then when somebody does complain, to thank them for caring enough to help us improve. Mm-hmm. And it changes the dynamic a lot.
Well, it's certainly valid to handle everything right there in the restaurant. And the comment cards, do you incentivize the servers to put those out there and create a dialogue with the customer to get them back, or do you, you know?
No, we don't. It's just part of their job is that the same way they're presenting the check,
okay,
in that same check packet goes the comment card.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
That has not been a problem to get that.
Yeah, I was impressed. I signed up for some newsletter. I think it was on the Gramercy Tavern site. And the next day I got an email from your manager thanking me and saying I'd be added. So I thought that was great follow-up.
Thank you.
So, you know, looking to the future, Danny, how do you view the role of technology in creating successful restaurants?
I think it's huge. I think it's huge in every industry. And, you know, I was a little bit of a Luddite for many years when it came to technology. You know, I don't know why, but I don't think we even got our first fax machine at Union Square Cafe till the 1990s, if you can believe it. And I used to type my newsletter on an IBM Selectric with Correcto tape. I am finally in the BlackBerry world. I would say that from a technology standpoint, the big items are guest recognition and accounting. And when I say accounting, I mean understanding your business as well as you possibly can. For years and years and years at Union Square Cafe, I would keep guest notes basically by working a 16-hour day on the door keeping most of it in my mind and in my heart, and keeping everything else on 5.5 by 7 index cards. You know, this one was here last year for her anniversary. This one,
I've been reading that. Yeah.
Allergic to shellfish. And I would say without any question, Open Table, which is a company that I invested in after actually rejecting the whole notion of online reservations for a couple of years, has done more to help me and my business and hospitality than anything else that I've come across. And for a lot of reasons, it allows me to virtually be in more places than one at any time. Because I start every day by doing what I call handicapping the reservation sheets with my staff. And we are then able to plot out where I'm going to spend which part of my day. We're able to convey messages to people, even if I'm not able to be at that restaurant at that time. And for the multi-unit restaurateur or for the single-unit restaurateur, it's just a godsend. And as a consumer, from the standpoint of going out to eat, it's also become a great marketing. It's a great way to really answer two questions. You know, the Zagat survey does a very, very effective job, and other survey, you know, other guides do a very effective job at helping people to answer the age-old question, honey, where should we go out to eat tonight?
Well,
or where do you want to go out to eat tonight? What Open Table is able to do is it's able to do that, but it's also able for a consumer to answer another question, which is, where can we eat out tonight? And to be able to answer both of those without having to pick up a telephone and get a busy signal or be put on hold is truly revolutionary. And so that's helping us a lot.
Absolutely. We're especially proud of Open Table because it launched right here in San Francisco, and I know that it's extremely viable. Well, Danny, I know that you're real involved with Share Our Strength, and just to touch base a little bit about, you know, working with nonprofit organizations and how important and viable that is, you know, as part of your community. Would you like to say maybe how that partnership started? Because I know many clients come to me and say, you know, how do we align ourselves with the right charity? There's so many options out there. Do you have any, maybe just a few tips you could share on how you would do that?
Well, I think it's a big decision to decide whether you want to be aligned with any charity. There's no law that says you need to do it. I've always had the guideline for myself that I should be interested in the topic, or it should be something that many of our guests are interested in, or it should be something that many of our staff members are interested in. And when you can find an intersection between all those interests, I think it's an incredible thing, and that's one of the things that Share Our Strength historically has provided for me, which is that hunger and hunger relief is obviously something that we think about all the time because that's what we do for a living. And our restaurants only exist because people have the means by which to pay money for food. And I think that we have a skill set, which is that we know how to prepare food. In order for me to continue to hire people who have a high HQ, I've got to find ways to exercise their hearts. People who derive pleasure from providing others with pleasure also have a need to exercise their heart, just like a thoroughbred horse needs to exercise its legs. And Share Our Strength, at the very core of it, even though it's an organization devoted to ending childhood hunger, it's truly an organization devoted to encouraging people to share their strengths, to volunteer. And so it's provided a wonderful intersection between my own interests and those of running my business and my staff. And because what Share Our Strength does so well is these tasting events, it also allows us to do this in an overlapping way with the pleasure of our guests, because we can contribute our food and our talents, and our guests can align themselves with us by paying money to come to the events. Mm-hmm. And it's been a great experience. But I would never tell anybody you know, whether they should align themselves with a health cause or an educational cause or an urban cause, a civic cause. I think any time you can find that intersection between you and your business and your staff and your guests, it's a beautiful thing.
Well said. So John, one of our callers, is asking, what would you do if you were not in the restaurant business?
I'd probably go to unemployment. I don't know. That's a great question. I definitely enjoy writing, and I wish I had time to write more. It took me about 3 years to write Setting the Table, because as those of you in the business understand, there's not a whole lot of extra minutes in the day. I think I'd probably try to spend 20% more time with my kids and my wife, and I would try to write.
Okay. And let's see, we have another question with regard to technology. Jane is asking, again, what is your opinion of the user review sites like Yelp and Chowhound, and if you have strategy with dealing with those amateur reviews? Like, I know I had one new restaurant we opened, and, you know, we'd have these couple of people come in and say, well, we're Yelpers, get ready. You know, you see how all the digital is going off, you know, in the face of a poor, unfair review. You know, do you have any strategy with working with those?
I think I've made some mistakes through the years. Early on, I think I got us involved in the actual online conversation, which is a big mistake. And you know what? I guess I've found that if it's way off base, there's usually somebody in that community that ends up getting into a fight with the person who was way off base, and so they kind of have your back for you.
Mm-hmm.
There have been a couple occasions where somebody just completely got their facts wrong, you know, saying we were going to open a restaurant where we were not going to open a restaurant, for example. And in that case, I would have someone from our PR department write in and introduce themselves and say, you know, I'd keep it light and say, you know, we're flattered or honored or whatever, happy to see that you're thinking about our restaurants. I'm so-and-so and in the PR department of so-and-so's company, and I just want to go on record as saying that as much as we would love to do that one day, that is absolutely not in our plans. And I think that's never gotten us in trouble.
Keep it positive.
It really is a positive. And I, on the other hand, if someone has said something incredibly nice, we have often figured out who they are. And then again, we use OpenTable, and we'll program something in OpenTable. And we still may not acknowledge, if they come to one of the restaurants, then not only do we know it, but we can pour on the VIP treatment. And we won't tell them we knew anything. We'll just do it. And then that just turns a friend into a friend with an even bigger megaphone.
Sure, lots of smiles. Customer evangelist. So let's see. We're almost running out of time, but Priscilla has a quick question. Who is your hero?
Oh, I'd have to say George Bush. I'm just kidding.
Okay.
I had a restaurant hero, unfortunately, who just died, who unfortunately just died, named Jean-Claude Vrinat, and he was the patron of a great restaurant in Paris called Taillevent, and Taillevent earned the Michelin 3-star rating under his watch for something like 34 consecutive years, which has to be a record. He, more than any restaurateur that I've ever met, really showed that you can balance refined dining with warm hospitality, because anywhere else I'd ever gone where the hospitality was that warm, the excellence wasn't there. And when the excellence was there, sometimes the feeling of warmth wasn't there so much. And he was able to do both. And I would go make pilgrimages there as often as I possibly could, to just try to learn how he was able to have such high standards with a twinkle in his eye which everyone says you can't do. They say nice guys finish last. Mm. And he, from the restaurant industry, was my greatest hero for sure. And outside of that, in life, I'd say my greatest hero is probably my wife, because I think that there's probably nothing harder than being a mom. We have four kids. She does more than her lion's share. She never gets a day off, and it's an amazing job she does.
That's great. Well, we're about ready to close. Danny, do you have any other final thoughts you'd like to share, or tips for success for our callers?
I would just want to say thank you to you for inviting me, and to the one of the hard things about this conversation is I have no idea who's on the call. I have no idea if I put you to sleep. I don't know what your body language is doing right now, but I do want to say that if any of you are on the call, ever find yourselves in New York, please introduce yourselves to us, and I'd love to have an opportunity, if possible, to meet you.
Well, there you go, an open invitation. We will certainly take you up on that, Danny. Thank you so much for sharing your tremendous wisdom with us. And for all the listeners, we so thank you for joining us on this call. And we encourage you to go out and buy Danny's book, Setting the Table. I believe it's probably at your local bookstore or Amazon, or I'm sure you can find it out there. Once again, this is Susie Beeler in San Francisco. I've been delighted to be your host for this teleseminar, which is brought to you by Restaurant Bootcamp. And we encourage you to visit Restaurant Bootcamp. The site is www.restaurantbootcamp.com for information on upcoming conferences and future teleseminars. Thank you again for listening, and Danny, have a great day. We so appreciate your time.
Thank you so much, Susan. Bye.
Thank you.